Good morning, everyone, and happy Mother's Day to us all. And we celebrate Mother's Day, obviously, as a tribute to those women who selflessly give of themselves to bring us into this world and to help us to grow up. But from a deeper, more spiritual point of view, what we're really celebrating is the quality of feminine energy perfectly expressed. Because from that, there is a great deal that all of us can learn. Everything that we are attracted to in the course of ordinary human life is not an end in itself, even though it appears to be because of our perspective. We think that to be healthy, to raise a good family, to have a good relationship, a successful career, a home, all the things that people want in life, we get very engaged in the thing itself as an end in itself. And this becomes extremely confusing at some inevitable point in the progress of our incarnation, whether it's somewhere in the middle or at the end, because at some point it all shifts and ultimately all dissolves in death itself. One way or another, whatever we've been doing this whole time is just going to go away. It's very interesting to contemplate imagining the astral world. And in the astral world, all that we have is our consciousness, and all of the factual conditions of our lives, success or failure, happiness or lack of it, wealth, poverty, whatever it might be, it's just all gone. Swamiji once, many years ago, there was a movement in California, an anti-nuclear weapons movement. And it was a very serious and a well-thought-out and well-conducted campaign. The details of it are obscure to me now. Some of the others of you may know. And a group of representatives from that organization came to Ananda. They wanted Swami Kriyananda to endorse the movement. I think it was political. I think there was something on the ballot. And they wanted Ananda's energy behind it. So they gave their presentation, which had been quite professionally worked out. And it was about the devastating effect of a nuclear bomb, which is, you know, nothing to laugh at. It's a big deal. And they had these charts, and they had a picture of a big city, and they had a specific city and the population of the city and where the bomb would hit and how many people would be vaporized, just simply vaporized, nothing left. How many people would be incinerated so that there would just be ash? How many people would be injured? How their deaths would take place? I mean, it was grim, really, really grim. And any thinking person would say, I think we don't want this to happen, and that was their intention. And Swami listened to it all the way through. But when they reached the end of it, he remarked, he said, I appreciate the sincerity of what you're doing, and I certainly endorse the cause. You know, war is folly. He said, at the same time, he said, to motivate people through the power of fear will not create peace. It will just create more fear. And then he remarked, and this is where I was going, it's more important today. He said quite simply, he said that 100 years from now, almost no one living on this planet now will still be living here. And whether we dribble off a few at a time over the next century or all go to the astral world at the same time, he said, when we're in the astral world, it won't make any difference at all. I mean, it was a very radical thing to make because the whole point was all about death and how you were going to die and whether you were going to die and when you were going to die and all of these different issues, as if that in itself was the motivating factor for why we should join this movement. It was an anti-death movement, which is pretty much doomed to fail. You know? No matter how effective it is, that's going to be the end story for every single one of us. Now, that could make you quite sad. You know, one of my friends who was as a young child became so terrified of death. And his parents tried to reassure him, oh, we're going to live a long time, you're going to live a long time. But his mind, in fact, was quite evolved. And he said, it doesn't make any difference how long it is, it's going to happen. And because his parents had no context, except just do the best you can and then you're obliterated, they couldn't comfort him at all. They sent him to a psychiatrist who couldn't comfort him at all. And he just lived a great deal of his life in terror until he found self-realization. And then all of a sudden, it was just picked up from a completely different string. And it was no longer this big question of, oh dear, everything that we're clinging to is going to be snatched out of our hands. It was that the whole perspective, the whole rules of the game are completely different. And we even come onto the spiritual path often with a desire to sincerely live for God, but not really a clear understanding of what that might mean. And we often think about the spiritual path in terms of how much easier our life is going to be now, and we make long lists of all the things that God has done for us. And Swami is always snidely remarking that finding a parking place when you really need one often is really, really high on that list. You know, and people will even show you the power. See, I can always find a parking place, or this nice apartment, or all of these other things. Well, it isn't that God is going to deliberately torture us. Oh, good, you're on the spiritual path. Nothing is going to go right for you anymore. Even though sometimes that is what happens. But the whole purpose of the path and the whole gift that God gives us is entirely different. And this is what I was thinking about mothers. The idea of a mother, the ideal of a mother, the ideal of mother love is that it's completely self-giving. And the ideal of a mother, when we think of ourselves, if we're going to imagine ourselves in that role, which I did when I was young, although I never acted it out, but the ideal of a mother to me was based on all the enormously noble and wonderful qualities that I would express as a mother. I would be entirely sensitive. I would always be conscious of what my child needed. I would myself be such a noble example that my child would always want to follow it. I mean, it just went on and on like that. And then one day I realized that the mere act of getting pregnant and giving birth to a baby was not really going to change my character. That was a really frightening moment, you know, that nothing would happen to me merely by giving birth to a baby. The character that I was would persevere despite that change. But there was one reality to it, and that was the point at which I started looking for something other than just getting pregnant. Because what I really wanted was a transformation of my character. And yes, it's true that the inspiration of caring about someone more than we care about ourselves has a way of bringing out of us a nobility of character that probably nothing else can. And many, many people, men and women, will say that it wasn't until they gave birth to a child that they really understood what true love is. My friend who raised two sons, who's a very generous-hearted man before his sons were born, slightly later in his life, he remarked once, he said, I thought I was a pretty selfless guy, but raising two boys 2 years apart, he said, I realized that selfless means no self, not less, but zero. And just the absolute fact that you're no longer yourself and your concerns are no longer the point. The point is simply, what may I give? Now, in my own progress from having wanted to have children to never having children and being delighted that I never had children, with all respect to mothers everywhere, because what I really wanted was that opportunity to have something be more important than myself. Not out of some perverse desire to punish myself, but a realization that the self that one is always protecting is not really the source of happiness that we imagine it to be. And that's what we're really looking for, is the source of our happiness and how we're going to get there. And I was really reflecting this morning on, if I were going to make a list of the gifts that I feel that God and Guru have given me, the very definition of the spiritual path, I would say it is the joy of serving and the opportunity to grow. The joy of serving and the opportunity to grow. And when I think back even to my youthful romanticism about having a baby and being a mother, I realized that what I wanted was the joy of serving and the opportunity to grow. In fact, it's been very interesting to me to look back over my whole life, which I came to the spiritual path in my late teens. When I was 18 is when I really started on the path of self-realization. So I really didn't have much of a life outside of this path. But even so far as my childhood ambitions, my adolescent dreams, and of course in the early teenage years are often a time of great idealism, even though the form of what I wanted, I never imagined cooperative communities or meditation or Eastern gurus or any of these things. They never ever entered my field of reality. I was born into an ordinary American life and lived an ordinary American life. This all came completely out of the blue. But what I always wanted was the opportunity to serve and the opportunity to grow. And whether we first define that as being popular and being a cheerleader and getting the whole school excited for the boys on the field or whatever it might be, or getting an education or learning to play an instrument or anything that we try to master, if we really think about it, we ourselves want to expand and then we want to give that expansion to others. My tremendous suffering as an adolescent before I found this path was I didn't know how to grow. I mean, I knew how to grow physically. I mean, you just sit there and that happens. But nobody around me had any wisdom to offer me in terms of telling me how to get somewhere that I really wanted to go. You know, they told me I could be successful in the world. They told me I could be an impressive academic. I could be a doctor. I could be anything. There was no limitation placed on me. But somehow, standing where I was standing, I could see the end of every one of those roads, and it was no place I wanted to go. And then even worse, being totally ignorant myself, what could I ever give to anyone else? And so there I was, just fired up. I used to say I was truly a fanatic without a cause. You know, I wanted to be 100% for something, but for what? And that was actually why I focused in on maybe I'll have 5 or 10 children, because I figured at least that was sort of solid, honest work. You know, kids have to be raised, and if I raise them, that would seem like it would be something worth doing. It was only when I realized that it wasn't going to be the opportunity for me that I thought it might be. Or even then, I had this thought one day that even if I had 12 children, it would still be a very small number. And the expansion of self would never really happen in the same way. Didn't have the word ego at the time. I didn't have the word that I would still be identified with such a limited reality that no matter how many people there were around me, I would still be trapped within my own reality. So the point of all of this also is this. One of the advice that's given to us in the Bhagavad Gita today, focusing more on that than on the Bible, the Gita comments about how the man of wisdom regards with equal affection, you might say, with equal affection, when things go well and when things go badly, when the world praises him or when the world condemns him, when great wealth comes to him or great poverty, when success or failure comes. And we hear this, and the only way we can imagine living in this world with that kind of detachment is by walling ourselves off a little bit from the experiences of life. Because isn't that how we, in fact, try to even out the ups and downs? We become just slightly indifferent. Or we become a little bit hard in our hearts, and we never really quite let it touch us. You know, Swamiji remarks about a certain person. He says, he seems detached, but he's not really detached, he's just closed off. And then he spoke about someone, about himself, in fact. He said, I may seem less detached, he said, but it's just because I'm willing to enter in completely into whatever life sends me. And real detachment is not because we have failed to embrace it and then we're safe because we're always standing here. That's just a very fancy word for fear, isn't it? That's just a very fancy word for self-protection. That means I won't go out and really open my heart to the world. I won't go out and really set myself a goal and give everything to it to see if I can achieve it. I won't really allow the full power of the infinite in any of its forms to flow through me, because what if it doesn't work? What if I end up hurt? What if it doesn't come out the way I want it to be? What if someone dies? You know, what if the world turns against me? Oh, my goodness, the list is long. You know, the list is very, very long of things that happen to people. But what we have to become detached from, and a better way to say it, is we have to become attached to the right aspect of things. And if we're deeply attached to the right dimensions of our life experience, then we're automatically detached in the right way from everything else. And I'll recommend too, the opportunity to give and the opportunity to grow. And when you apply that to every situation, then it goes one way or another. And really, in the end, what difference does it make? Because we have set our sights on that which will go through all the different waves. Swamiji writes in the expanded commentary on this, he said, many of life's experiences, if we can stand back just a little bit, are quite interesting and instructive. If we haven't identified ourselves with some ephemeral aspect of life so deeply that when it cracks apart, we think that we ourselves have cracked apart. And the reason to think this way is very, very simple. Otherwise, we suffer. Otherwise, we suffer. Otherwise, we struggle. Otherwise, we are in a constant state of resistance to that which is happening. I don't have a rubber band in front of me, but pretend there's one between my fingers, wrapped around my fingers like this. Stress is created when one point is fixed and the other is pulling, and the fixed point won't move. And so then the rubber band gets very, very taut, which is our minds, our emotions, our expectations. We're just always living in this state of what might happen, because something is always going to happen. Sometimes when people have presented to me very, very difficult situations, what's going to happen? I always say, oh, something will happen. Something always happens, you know? But in our own minds, it's like, something will happen. Yeah, something will always happen. And depending on what we're attached to, it will either be interesting and instructive, or it will be the fixed point and pulling the other way. But, you know, if you just move along with it, God is always taking us somewhere. It's so amazing to me. Sometimes the simplest things in life seem so remarkable to me. We've now, you know, run this school here, Living Wisdom School, for some 20 years, and people that used to be small are now large. Gary McSweeney's son, Brian, he was very skittish when he first came into our lives, and he was small enough to crawl under these chairs, which he did often. For example, when you spoke to him or looked at him, he would crawl under those chairs, and I had breakfast with him, and I had to talk to him like this the whole time, and he's a really big, tall person, and nothing happened in between except time. He just got bigger. Something always happens, doesn't it? You know, all of us are just moving through. Whether that's interesting or instructive depends on what we ourselves are attached to. Don't worry about the negative side of it. Don't worry about pushing things out of the way. Oh, I must be more detached. I must be more detached. I must be more detached. I remember when I was first married to David, and it was the early years of Ananda, and we gave each other a lot of what I've come to call true but highly irrelevant spiritual advice. And we had been, you know, together just a few months, and David's life at that time, he traveled a lot. I think I traveled a little, but we were separated sometimes. And we had a 3-week separation at one point, which, you know, that was a very high percentage of the life we'd had together. And it just went on and on and on as far as I was concerned. The 3 weeks was about 2 years. It just went on and on and on. And some pious would-be yogi came in and said to me, now be careful, you mustn't get attached. I looked at him. Do you think I would have married this man if I didn't really like him? What a stupid thing to suggest to me. Of course I'm attached to him. That's what I've set my whole life to do right now, is to be his wife, to live with him. Of course I'm attached. You know, give me some advice that I can do something with. You know, so we can't solve our problems by saying, well, I like my wife, but not really that much. You know, like, how well does that work? Probably some of you have tried it. Tell me, it doesn't work very well, does it? Not at all. You know, if you're going to do it, you have to give your whole heart to it. Swamiji has one of the songs we often sing, Walk Like a Man, Go On Alone. It's called, Give Life Your Heart. Bless everything that's grown. And then the next line, fear not the loving. All this world's your own. It's just beautiful. I must have heard it 1,000 times in my life. It never fails to thrill me. Fear not the loving. All this world's your own. So what we have to be attached to, I mean, to have detachment from the up and down waves of life, is because we have attached ourselves so deeply to the ocean that we have just given ourselves so completely to something that's bigger than all the small parts that we experience the small parts as they are. You're on a stormy sea, the boat goes up and down. You know, really interesting, sometimes intensely challenging adventures come to us. We lose conditions that we are absolutely devoted to. People that have been everything to us cease to be part of our lives for God knows what reason, many, many different reasons, including death itself. So is this an interesting and instructive experience? If we're attached to the opportunity to give and the opportunity to grow, then all the other attachments just take care of themselves. And you see, life becomes so much more of a positive adventure. How much can I give to this situation? But we're not so much giving to this one and this one and this one. We're just giving because it's our nature to do so. You know, I realized in my own particular life, just speaking because it's Mother's Day and I honor all mothers, this is not anything to do with anyone's choices, but it's a question of how we best can express ourselves. You know, it was never for me to take care of one or two or 25 individual people and raise up their little bodies. Even though even today I see a baby and I go, oh, you know, it just still comes out of us. And the reason God plants that in us is because we need to have the experience of no self over and over and over again. So that what we become attached to is not husband, wife, home, pets, children, but what we become attached to is having no self. Ah, now that's the real joy of it, isn't it? We think that it's the self-aggrandizedness that makes us happy. I am the mother of so-and-so. I joked, when the children who grow up at Ananda, because many of us don't have children, and especially the early families, there were a lot of children that we all watched grow up. And so many of us have a proprietary interest in many of these children, which sometimes exceeds the boundaries of their interest in our proprietary interest. I was joking with Peter Kretzmann, who's a grown man now who lives in Ananda, Los Angeles, and he gets a lot of advice from a lot of people, including me. And I remembered in India there is a blessing that's offered to a woman when she's married, and some people don't like this because it's sort of not pro-woman. It's a little bit male chauvinist, people say. But the blessing is, when you're married, my child, may you be the mother of 1,000 sons, like that. I said, well, Peter, somehow when you were born, it got a little scrambled, and when you were born, may you be the son of 1,000 mothers. And I know many of the young people who are now adults at Ananda Village who have people like me coming in and acting as if we have rights over their lives merely because we watched them grow up. You know, the curse got a little confused in there. But what we're really looking for is to go back to where we were. You know, God gives us this longing, this deep longing to find romantic love. And then often from that romantic love to create families. God gives us that experience so we can experience what we're really looking for. And what we're really looking for is no self. We think we're looking for self-aggrandizement, but what we're really looking for is no self. And raising children is a really, really good way to learn that. you just devote yourself tremendously to them, and then they just run off and do the oddest things, don't they? Just the oddest things. I can hardly remember without it moving my heart. Now I'm in it. I have to finish. When I was 18 years old, my father, I was very close to my father when I was growing up, but when I reached a certain age, 18, I realized that our destiny was not together. You know, my destiny was where I am now, and he wasn't on this wavelength and never was. And we were not going to spend our lives close, and I knew it. And also at that time, I was conscious of the fact, and I say this to parents who are facing this, that his happiness was too wrapped up in me, and that I couldn't take responsibility for it because my own life was going to be challenging enough, and I simply could not take responsibility for his happiness. So almost consciously, I separated myself from him, and I remember when he saw it, you know, and it's the only time I ever saw him cry. But there was nothing I could do. I didn't know yet where I was going. Now I can say what Swami says. If we give our lives to God, everyone that was close to us in our lives will be blessed by that. But it was also so instructive for me because there he was. And part of me thought, did you really think I was going to live the rest of my life for you? You know, did you honestly really think that I was going to do that? And just part of me was, oh, it just made me so sad. Because how could you depend on that? You conceive a child, with all due respect, you have no idea what you're getting. Absolutely no idea. You don't know whether that's a friend or an enemy, or a kindred spirit, or someone who has just no attunement with you at all. How could you expect that your happiness would come from there? This is what the Bhagavad Gita is warning us about. You know? It's like happiness comes from the opportunity to give and the opportunity to grow. And from attaching ourselves to that which will never disappoint us, which is the infinite spirit within. And only that. And the promise of that, although at the beginning it seems like a disappointment, every saint, every great master promises us everything we seek. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added unto us. This is the promise, and God has the power to keep that promise if we simply open our hearts to him. God bless you.